Blog Talk Radio.
Peace to the ancestors. Yes. Peace to Dr. Cornell West. Yes. Peace to the movement. Yes. We came from the bottom. Ever since they got us, we've been going through these problems. 400 years behind, and it's no promise that we gon' never actually be equal, to be honest. It's messed up how they put us in chains, kidnapped our language and changed our names. But when we speak Ebonics, then they call it a shame. They leave us with a couple options, rob or slang. Now we locked up again. How much can our skin take? We went from slaves to inmates, carrying the weight of the 50 states. Working your forms, black nannies carrying white babies in their arms. Black men sacrifice their lives in your wars, but you don't never show appreciation here at home. You treat us so damn wrong. You act like you hate my race. The police, they just beat us in the streets like an 808 base. America, when will you defend my case? You never will, cause your freedom is fake. I'm only living here cause I wanna get paid enough to round up all my family and shake.
Get up, get up. Get up, get up. Get up, get up. Get up, get up.
They done tore down all the PJs in my barrio. Gang units for worst case scenario. Might work till a couple of quirks. Can't call it pancakes cause you pour some syrup. It's a whole lot bigger than a pretty new house, especially when the road is still running about. P. Diddy running marathons, racing dough. That's going to the school where the tax money go. Homeland security now, there's a phenomenon. Pacifying folks by hanging Saddam. Troops still riding, still obliging. Still no Bin Laden. Tuned in waiting for the president's announcements. No 40 acres, take these 40 ounces. We ain't gon' get on the levees. Revolution televised early. Is you ready?
Why you wanna treat me so cold, America?
Forced to climb, instead of how your back heavy, beat and lost your mind. Especially when you done been down for so much time. Getting up don't even really ever cross your mind. You got pawn shop, gun shop, liquor store sign. SWAT team, crack fiends, unemployed line. Stay late, dollar short, trying to buy time. What we do to survive is defined as a life of crime. You can't ball, then you forced to grind. If you fall, then you cross the line. And I've been putting in work from 9 to 5 and 5 to 9. Since phone calls cost a dime. What it made me is one of the relevant, highly intelligent. Brothers not only dealing with the same drugs selling. If I'm a hustler, let them, what's more American? We all founded on the same drug
America,
heritage.
Why you wanna treat me so cold, America?
Show, one of the hottest shows across the nation, Dr. Mary Lee Live, coming all the way from the East Coast. We're going to be continuing our topic from last week, Saving Our Babies. The music you heard in the background was produced by Dr. Cornell West on Hidden Beach Records back in 2007. The first rapper you heard was I Riz the Moment, followed by Rod Digga, Black Thought, and of course, Dr. Cornell West. The music is self-produced by Corey Coach Tatum. And we have a great lineup tonight. I'm going to have a young man. He's going to come on. He's going to talk to you about a video, and he's going to introduce our rest of our guests. We have Brother Trace McMillan. He's going to be taking over. Are you with us, Brother Trace?
Absolutely, I'm here. Let's get straight to it. Trace McMillan, I'm one of the co-hosts here. We're going to pick up where we left off. We're doing a part three of Save Our Babies. By this video, I would love to play. I have it loaded up and ready here. I'm going to play it, and then I'll pass it to Dr. James Cannon. And here we go.
A local prosecutor's office is creating a new position to help young offenders get a second chance.
Telling you this, Gwinnett County Bureau Chief Tony Thomas says prosecutors are looking at lighter sentences.
James's position inside the Gwinnett DA's office is believed to be the first of its kind in Georgia. Now, the DA, the new employee, was a mom on a mission just 3 years ago, trying to save her son from a life prison sentence. Now, district attorney getting order before sentencing.
What we make about the odds there that I think you can imagine.
Since her now 18-year-old son went to prison, Martin Suggs got her private investigator's license. Beginning next month, she'll investigate the backgrounds of underage offenders.
I am violent for a long time,
okay. So that was the mitigation investigator at the end who was interviewed about a mother whose son is sentencing, he was sentenced outrageously, and now he's getting a, essentially, we could say a greater hand and opportunity at life, but she's, her purpose is to really be that vocal, to be that human who can who can mitigate the change and create the change that's needed within our young black youth. And she explained how the system and how the processing of being detained, arrested, or going to jail. She talked about how it was corrupt and the things that we do and don't know. And so, with her own testament with her son, she's using that as her way to make change for not just her family, but for other black parents and mothers who've suffered from losing their children due to our justice or legal system. So with that same breath, I'll pass it to...
Good evening, everyone. This is Dr. Lee. Dr. Cannon is joining us later. But we're happy that you're here. We want you to... you're always welcome to tap one on your phone for comments and or questions. We are continuing saving our babies tonight. And we're looking forward to everything everyone has to offer. I think we're going to start tonight with Dr. Longs. Dr. Longs, if you would, the floor is yours to update those who are new tonight regarding this initiative and things that are going on with our children. Dr. Longs. Dr. Longs. Okay, we're going to Dr. Moncrief.
Okay.
Hello, this is Dr. Moncrief. It's good to be on tonight. I'm looking forward to the show, the third part of Saving Our Babies. Our kids are going to jail for crimes that some of them have committed, some of them may not have, and they're going for these long periods of time, our babies. And so I think this dialogue is important tonight, that we figure out, you know, how we can actually save our babies from committing these crimes, and then once they're in the system, how we can help them get what they need from the system in order for them to come out and be productive. So I'm just basically tonight listening.
Okay, thank you so very much, and welcome again. Dr. Bowles, we thank you for joining us again tonight, and we'd like to hear from you. We know that you've done a lot of work, you know, in the, in the area of psychology and medicine. So we'd like to hear from you tonight.
Good evening, everyone. Thank you so much, Dr. Lee, for inviting me. The topic of the imprisonment of young people, particularly young Black people, is near and dear to my heart. For about 18 months, right after Hurricane Katrina, so that was like 2005 through 2006, I worked with a very forward-thinking judge in New Orleans who wanted to have a physician evaluation of young people who were not questioning whether they were guilty or not, but if they were culpable for the crime. And I don't hear that particular concern in many Department of Justice cases. If you are Black and an offender, regardless of age, it appears the intent is to be done with you, just lock you up and forget if they can. And the unfortunate thing, Dr. Lee, is oftentimes when persons go to prison, they are forgotten. I intentionally put myself into an environment to learn more, and the more I learned, the more painful it was. I had no idea, and I can only speak to the Louisiana system, which many of you will know is unlike the other 49 states in the United States. Louisiana is still based on Napoleonic law, and all other states are British. And some people say, what? That's true. We are holding out. So a number of the statutes and basic decisions are unique to Louisiana. And unfortunately, at age 14, a child can be treated or tried as an adult. And whenever, and this is a shout out to those of us who should be doing mentoring or parents who have children, when the courts do not have a voice to speak up for this young person, now I don't mean a court-appointed lawyer, I mean a family, a minister, a community leader, they're apt to get a more harsh judgment and treatment. And the thinking there is, if there is no community connection, then that offender will be a repeat offender. Now, please hear me. If you don't have a preacher, a teacher, a mother, an auntie, a grandmother, someone who can, during the court hearing, give some communication that there is a tie to the community, the judgment comes out harsher. So that gives the responsibility back to the community. I say community instead of neighborhood, because community to me includes the church and the school and the homes and the people, of course, in that setting. When a child is facing a threat of imprisonment, whether they committed the deed or not, the punishment is more severe if no one speaks up. That's the first point. Second point, in Louisiana, they pay 3 cents an hour for different jobs that a person may get on work release. And we all know 3 cents an hour means nothing. Before COVID-19, I went with a nonprofit group and we were visiting the Louisiana State Penitentiary they call Angola. And I was so disturbed. It took me weeks to recover because when I went, they were talking about a fellow who had been in prison for 32 years, and he was wearing the same pair of shoes that he had for those 32 years, and he was overcome with joy that he finally received enough money to buy another pair of shoes. So if there's no family who put money on the books, I don't know, I think that's how they refer to it, is you have to put money in their account. They will earn 3 cents an hour. So if someone for 32 years had to wear the same pair of shoes because he had no outside support and his only source of income is, as I mentioned, 3 cents an hour. So when they talk about imprisonment, it really is a form of slavery. As far as Louisiana is concerned, the highest incarcerating state in the nation. Men from age 19 to 35, if you are black, you have something like a 15 times more likely to be in prison than in college. So there's a lot of ugly statistics. And since the topic is Save Our Children, my comment is we as a community need to be more active in the everyday life of young people, that you cannot simply send someone to school and say, well, he's in school and the school will take care of it. We've gotten away from, at least from my experience, the church involvement. So I don't know what happened there, where there was a choir practice and Sunday school. Then it was after certain activities, they would host either a party or some kind of a gala. The deacons of the church were like big brothers and made sure that young boys had a male mentor. There are activities where a young man was able to have male-dominated type activities. And I don't see that. I grew up in North Carolina, not in Louisiana, so I don't know if Louisiana ever really had it, but I can certainly say that North Carolina did. So that's my comment at the beginning of this presentation, and I'm anxious to hear what other solutions someone may put forth, and certainly where the young people's opinions are.
Thank you so very much. You've made some very, very valid and very important points here, comments here, that we should be absolutely considering. And I guess I didn't really know, you know, of course, I've been a part of, you know, writing letters and helping from the, you know, community side when young people or I've been asked to write letters for, but I wasn't certain, you know, sometimes with the outcome that it was even doing any good. But now I hear you saying that the community involvement is critical and during the sentencing time, and I'm really floored to hear that someone has worn the same shoes for 32 years. Because, I mean, it took 32 years to earn enough money to buy a pair of shoes at 3 cents an hour. So, thank you so much.
Well, that's like I said, I did the visit with a group over a holiday, and it ruined my Christmas. I couldn't imagine you're somewhere, you have limited freedom, someone decides when you shower, how much out daylight time, and a lot of the incarcerated take these jobs, which are 3 cents an hour, just so they're not in this, I think it's something like 7.5 by 8 feet is the dimensions of the room where two people are all the time. Right. So, you know, just being present and seeing the conditions took all of the joy of that Christmas away from me, not to complain, but it certainly let me see another lifestyle, if you want to call it that, where a person had no freedom. When you say incarcerated, it's not just physical. It's also more than a little mental.
Yes, right. Thank you so much. We're going to welcome Dr. Don Tynes. Dr. Tynes, are you with us? Dr. Tynes.
Yes, ma'am.
Well, welcome, and thank you for joining us. And the floor is yours.
Can I just say something following with Dr. Bowles?
Yes.
That what's so important about what Dr. Bowles said, and then relating to the work of Dr. Claude Anderson and what happened in Vietnam, what happened in Korea, and our failure as adults since the 70s, once the grassroots turned over the human rights, civil rights movement to the black bourgeoisie, who is currently our congressional state representatives, these individuals, we have lost ground. We have lost everything. They've screwed up, bottom line. And then what happened is we moved away from those fabrics that Dr. Ball talked as family, unity, look out for each other, that we tried to whiten up instead of tightening up into what we already had. But I want people to realize this, based on what she just said. Dr. Claude Anderson will tell you that the 13th, 14th, 15th Amendment only related to the African Americans, to the descendants of enslaved Africans. And that the 13th Amendment said that if you're not in prison and you're black, you're free. But if you are in prison and you're black, you are still considered a slave in the United States in 2022. The 15th Amendment says that if you were a human being, then you would have full rights in America to vote, to do other these things. And because we're not full human beings, therefore we don't have these rights. Now, so not being full human beings and the fact that we still are considered slaves if we're in prison, and the fact that a prison is the same thing as being a POW, and that what we know from the slave writings and the slave literature is they never called themselves slaves. They considered the word slave a dirty word. They considered the same as saying nigger or the N-word. And so they call themselves as POWs, and writers would change POW, which means prisoner of war, into slave, son of slave, descendants. And then our mentally injured leaders would proudly say that they were great-grandsons and great-granddaughters of slaves. That's when you pass on mental illness. And so we have to look at the death toll that's happening by police lynchings, either by bullet or by suffocation. We have to look at the lynchings that are happening in the justice system of our children. Well, now they're going after our children. If they're 11 years old, 12 years old, trying to try them as adults. Then we also see that they're going after our children, that in our communities we have excess lead poisoning, and they try to put us in special ed, which means we're especially dead because they do not provide the resources to uplift us academically. And we know from research that if you give a lead child extra academic resources, they will excel beyond that of a child who has never been. We know that we've always tolerated them killing us and not doing full resuscitation or 10-minute resuscitation like they do in Europe or greater to our black babies. We also know that they're now killing our mothers on the maternity war table. They even tried to take out Serena Williams. So with all this attempts and all this death, and then on Sunday, I was made aware that even though we had a federal meeting, we had state meetings, we had county meetings on the treatment of COVID using monoclonal antibodies and monoclonal pills, that blacks are told to quarantine, whites are told to treat. So if we can really look at this and see that the black race is under attack, and we have to start realizing that they're at war. You want to focus on Ukraine, but the body, look at the body count here in America. And the other thing, talking with the young people just recently, and the adults always want to say they want to get with the youth and talk to the youth, when you don't know a damn thing about the youth. All you know is from your time period and not what they're living through. So every single adult on here, unless you open your ears and shut your mouth and hear what they have to say and learn from them, because you don't know a damn thing. You can't do a damn program or anything unless you first learn what's going on in their life and their reality. And I got some young people here, you can ask them that. So we all coming from a time frame and a time period that they're not living through. And we did not protect them. We did not protect, we didn't, Trayvon Martin. We didn't protect Sandra Bland. We didn't protect Eric Gardner. We didn't protect the young lady with George Floyd and Breonna Taylor. We have not protected our children and our people. So don't go around lecturing when you will not tell them the truth about the racism and your friends and the blacks who sell us out. So the death count is too high. The prison count is too high. And when they're being charged slave labor wages, that they're saying that we now have to wake up. We cannot pretend and be intellectualizing when the cemetery don't lie, the body count don't lie. So we have to change and make sure that our actions are meaningful and not superficial. Our actions have to be substantial, that the kids can touch it, feel it, and relate to it and build from it. And it has to come from them. Dr. Boyles made a good point. She told us that we looked at our movement. Young Dr. King went against the old timers in the civil rights movement. We had Fred Hampton. We had Bobby Seals. We had Angela Davis. We had even the wife of Bobby Seals. We had young people leading us to this new reality that we have. Us old timers, we're for counsel. We're not for war. So we're everyone who's here greater than 40 years old, you are old timer. You are for counsel, not for war. It's the young people's fight to get it right where we messed up. Thank you, Dr. Lee.
You're very welcome now, and I appreciate you. So could you just, I know you've expounded some. Could you just, itemize some examples of how we did not protect our children? Because there may be someone here.
All right, let me go quickly. So number one, in the educational system, they separate our children, and we don't even so the whole thing of the IQ test, that was initially to separate the black from the white, but the white failed that test. The other thing is there was no such thing as special ed until the 60s and 70s when you started with integration. So we did not fight that. We didn't fight to maintain our schools. The other thing we did not do for our youth to keep our families stable, when silly black people were confused and tricked into having and supporting single family homes, where, in other words, only the mother and the children could be there, and they had to kick the daddy out. So they destabilizing the black family homes, when 75% of all black homes had husband and wife and children, and only 50% in the white, so we didn't do that. So also, when we went to the education of kids, when we went to send our kids to a predominantly all-white female class, and we have to understand that the 17 Casual Killing Act was because white women were beating black slaves together, and to prevent them from being prosecuted for damaging another person's property, they had to have a special law to protect white women from killing black men, women, and children. So, and the work called Death at an Early Age by Jonathan Kozol showed that the beating that was being done to black kids when they were creative and expanding upon. So we also see about the Jawaza Kunjufu, the conspiracy to destroy black boys. We see that going up into the early years that the black boys score on a genius level, and the further they go on the education level, they become a dummy down. We have not stopped or said anything about that. In the school systems, we see in Detroit school systems, where you're close to, where we had Deborah McGriff come in with and brought in Dr. Ivan Van Sertum, Dr. Asa Hilliard. We went and did an African-centered program where we had the lowest dropout rate. We had the highest attendance rate, and the kids went from gang banging to slanging the red, black, and green medallion. We increased their self-esteem, and then we overturned that and brought in Sharon McPhail and those guys, and went from the being recognized by 20 Minutes and others as turning the school around academically by introducing correct black history. That's all we did. And then we did not support her. We just did not support them. Look at the fact that Dr. Claude Anderson has been 30 years in the Supreme Court fighting for reparations and fighting for reparations from the American Indians. What kind of support have we done for him? So we have to look at the children now in the educational system. Look how hard we fought to get marijuana to be so people can smoke it, but we did not change. We have African-centered education in our school systems anymore. We don't even have community centers in our school anymore. We don't even have anything based where we have rites of passage for our boys and girls to go. So what have we have there for our kids to make sure that they can be sitting there black and proud like they did? Well, breakfast programs that were created by the Black Panthers, what programs do we have? What after-school programs do we have that are pro-black, just like the Chinese have pro-black Chinese programs, the Japanese pro-programs, the Chaldeans where you are have pro-Chaldean programs, the Jews. Everybody has pro-programs, but we want to always focus on whites because any black person who's talking now, who's elderly, has been damaged by post-traumatic slave disorder, post-traumatic slave syndrome, and they're always going to put other races before their races, and that's how you know you have mental illness, and we're not putting our children first to build them a legacy. Academically, economically, educationally, what have we done? What financial legacy have we done or what we're teaching them? And we allow movies and white directors to tell us how black people culture is supposed to be, and we allow blacks like Russell Simmons and others to create this gang culture and all this stuff, and going against the positive cultures that we had with KRS-One, Boogie Down Production, Public Enemy, we have been silent. We have let them do these things to us and our children, and are still doing it right now. And we're still not holding blacks accountable in Congress, in the Senate, anywhere. We do not hold blacks accountable when they do wrong or let wrong happen to us.
Mm-hmm. Absolutely. You're absolutely right. We have a young man here tonight, Byron D. Brooks. He is grad student right now. And Byron was born in prison and was formerly homeless for 2 years at the start of his collegiate journey. So, Byron, I want to welcome you. And you heard the comments and, you know, our particularly regarding not supporting and not protecting our youth. Could you share, you know, some more about your, to hear your comments of about, you know, what us as adults can do or not do, and also where you are now here in life, and how you have, you know, for yourself, you know, been persistent and resisted the types of things that could have happened, but you know you've accomplished so much and you know on your own, and you know how does that feel, Byron?
Good evening. Hope all of you all are doing well. First, I would agree that, you know, in terms of when we look at talking about saving our youth, I feel like first is, again, acknowledging as brother acknowledged, like, systemic things that have been set apart to put that has put us in the situation that we currently are in terms of our communities, our youth and infrastructure, like you said, thinking of things that have been weaponized against the Black family as a whole. For instance, that was talked about how for family to get welfare, the father could not be in the home and things of that nature, and how generational systemic tactics have in a way attacked the Black family. And by attacking the Black family, now you have hindered the Black youth because of that disconnect. So it's all about bridging back those reconnections, and again, you know, building on those relationships. Like, I was raised by my great grandparents due to my being born in prison, and the things that they instilled into me and the love they showed, the agape love, you know, unconditional love that they showed to me really helped me to, when I did have struggles in my life, I was able to go back to those teachings of which they taught me. And I think that's very important as well. Communication is key.
Thank you so much. And that aligns up with what Dr. Bowe said earlier, you know, regarding the community and, you know, and family, you know, being there, that support that's needed, as what your great-grandparents provided. Thank you. We're going to ask Trace co-host to, you know, to give us your thoughts at this juncture.
Yep, Trace here. I'm so glad that what was said. I appreciate Doctor for saying that, because, man, it's that serious and it runs that deep. And I've been waiting to have this conversation for a very long time. But are the listeners and the speakers ready to have this conversation? Because it runs very deep. He talks about how the elders have forsaken the youth, et cetera, et cetera. Which in that light is correct. And it goes back to where we're at as a people, a Black people. You know, oftentimes I would have these conversations with the youth, but they wouldn't even understand. They couldn't even grasp what I was trying to say. So I was like, man, maybe it's just not the time and place to have these conversations. But what I've discovered is that as Black people, we do lack culture. You know, there's Black History Month, there's these things, but that does not defy what culture is. Action doesn't necessarily defy what culture is. Culture is what we have when we don't have the celebrations. Examples, mental health foundations, engagement. You know, I'm blessed enough, like after the first lady spoke, I'm blessed enough to be able to have like a church environment, a church home, church area, you know, people in my church who can vouch for me. But that has to be something that all Black people, we all need that. We all need somebody to vouch for us, but we also need our elders as well. And so I think it's a pretty equal thing on both ends, because, yeah, he has a lot. Yeah, doctor has a lot of very valid points when he talks about the elders not necessarily being there, but have we been there for our elders, though? Because it gets to the point where we have to be able to communicate as adults. Even as people that are not necessarily adults yet, we still have to be able to groom those people to be able to have tough conversations. And us as young adults, we should be able to listen to our elders as well, because just the same reasons why they haven't been there, the elders could have reasons why they couldn't or why they haven't. You know, there's a new era, a new age that we live in with all this technology, all this social awareness, social media, social monitoring. There's new ways to navigate in today's world, in today's era, and that's life altering for everybody. There's a lot of angles to talk about to reach about this topic, but it all starts with creating a culture which can defy a legacy. We have to be educated historically, but also financially. You know, oftentimes you think about Black people who are successful, it's always You know, athletes or rappers or producers, people who do things, what about ownership? We need to take back ownership within our community. We go to Walmart, we go to Kroger's, we go to Meijer's, we go to all these stores, but all these stores are honestly white-owned. There might be a few black owners, but they're not founded. We need our own grocery stores. There's foods that we should be eating as black people that root all the way back to Africa. There's hundreds of different types of ginger, but we just go to the store and buy whatever is there. But in reality, we need to have our own – we need to have money within our own communities, and that type of information and knowledge could easily come from our elders, because the people that's in those positions, they're not giving out any free game. They're not giving out any life-altering information. You have to, you know, pay, which is okay. When are we going to be able to make a shift and realize that we are the ones that should be owning these things, so therefore we can bring our community up just by spreading information alone?
You're absolutely right. And, of course, this Neighborhood Commerce Institute, again, and this is why we're having this this talk, this show. This is why we talk here, to bring an awareness. And then out within the services that NCI provides is to develop, you know, programs and projects of based on what our communities want, what our neighbors want, you know, right on down into the neighborhood. You are so absolutely right. There's been so much information that has not been provided to us as a people. I totally agree with the culture factor. We've been whitewashed. We don't know who we are. Our babies were taken from us. We were forbidden to learn to read or write. We were forbidden to even practice our culture. So we're a totally, everything that we're doing is white, period. Everything that we're doing, because we are operating by what has been taught to us from, you know, elementary school, within our neighborhoods, from our ministers. We're even taught, you know, during when we were supposedly, you know, set free and even during slavery, when the pastors, black ministers, you know, were able to stand and teach and preach before us, they were given the Bible that had been, which is a collection of manuscripts that had been altered, rewritten. We were told, those ministers were told what to preach, what to teach. Whites would stand on the outside of the church door, you know, with the black, the slave churches, and listen to what that preacher was teaching, to be absolutely sure that he wasn't teaching and preaching anything other than what they had taught. Now, so I take serious issue with that today, because those been, you know, passed down through, you know, from our ancestors all the way down to today to us. And so what is truth? You know, that's a whole nother topic. But my point is that, no, we're not living in our culture. Spirituality, we were spiritual people. We were spiritual. Our culture is spiritual. But we've been given religion. This is what has happened to us. And so who are we? You know, but we have to start somewhere. So we're starting here. Things that I've learned over the past so many years, I'm taking those experiences, and I am taking it to, you know, our people, to our community, services and sources of funding on how to develop your businesses as, you know, entrepreneurs, whatever type of business you want. So information, not only access information, but also the services that are needed that they're not going to tell you or share with you, you know, for seeking funding, for organizing, for setting up. And, you know, someone mentioned earlier that, you know, we have to pay. Yes, we have to pay, but even when you pay them, you're not getting everything that you can get. You're paying for a service. Even if you get a few dollars in a grant opportunity somewhere, it's not going to be enough in order for you to be a success. It's going to be enough for you to just kind of get lost in the system and not be able to go back and get any more. So I know projects and programs that were white and others who, you know, would get significant amount of money to start up their businesses. But they always tell us, because I've been there, but they always tell us, you know, oh, baby steps, start with $25,000, $5,000, $50,000, even up to $250,000 or so. They don't mind giving you that, but they mind giving us the amount that we need to be an extreme success. And so, you know, there's so very much that I want to move on to. I want to open the floor to Dr. Long.
Hi, how's everybody tonight? Hello. Can you hear me?
Good. Yes, we can. Great. Thank you.
All right. Yeah, earlier I just, you know, I'm trying out these ear pods and somehow I muted myself with them in my ears. But, you know, going back to our topic in terms of how do we save our babies, and I was listening to everyone provide their input, and, you know, I agree with everything everybody's saying. But at the same time, as I'm listening, I have to correlate our topic with individuals that I see on a daily basis. So, and what I want to share, I'm going to utilize a contact, which is pretty much an example of a daily contact I see downtown as the mental health director and a psychiatrist at the Wayne County Juvenile Detention Facility, where I happen to engage a young man, 16, and I don't know why 16 seems to be the median age right now downtown in terms of kids are being adjudicated. But this is a 16-year-old male who was on the run for almost a year. So he committed this crime, which is a felony murder, a little bit over a year ago. He had a writ out on him from the prosecutor's office. So what that means, you know, you just think of what I'm saying in terms of a 16-year-old. And for the physicians on the line and the other clinicians, when you think about a 16-year-old in terms of their frontal lobe development, tendencies to be very impulsive. And with, I'd say with our kids right now, their lack of education and knowledge can lead to situations, unfortunately, where this young kid finds himself in. So here's a kid with felony murder in terms of how we save him. Well, the prosecutor has already decided to try him as an adult. So what that means in terms of court waivers, you know, the prosecutor can decide to waive his trial in the juvenile court and send it right over to the circuit court, which is Frank Murphy Hall of Justice. So now, despite that being the fact, and when he goes to court, he actually goes before a judge in the circuit court, yet he's housed in the facility in which I try to engage these kids. He's in the juvenile detention facility. And recently, latter part of 2021, there was a mandate such that even young people who were 18, 19, who had similar charges such as felony murder and some other things, they could not be housed in the jail, so they have to come over to the juvenile facility. But in terms of how do we save these individuals in these circumstances, and like I've advocated, you know, numerous times and even on other programs, and I guess it leads to what Dr. Tynes was saying, is that you know, we need to sit back and shut up and listen. And it does begin with that, because if we don't do that, we won't get an understanding as to how these young people are thinking. So today I spent approximately 2.5 hours with this young man. And even the 2.5 hour engagement is something that I had to develop over the last year or so, where initially my goal was to see as many kids on a daily basis as I could. But one thing I learned from that is that, you know, if I'm looking at just soul numbers, if I want to see 20 people today, I'm really not going to get a lot from each individual. So I've broken it down to giving each kid at least 2.5 hours of my time. Only problem is I'm the only psychiatrist in this facility. We have 120 kids, which means I may be able to get through 5 kids a day. Yet, how do I get to this person's understanding of, number one, the judicial system? I'm not a lawyer. I'm his physician, first of all. So I have to encourage him to trust me that I don't have any decision-making on in terms of what the judge is going to do or what they're not going to do. But he's 16, finds himself in this particular wage system into the circuit court. Now, with that, I just want to give some other descriptions in terms of just the legal part. We have some kids downtown who are given a blended sentence. Now, that's probably the majority, meaning this same 16-year-old commits a crime, let's say is associated with the crime of murder, and let's say he wasn't the trigger, he didn't pull the trigger, which undoubtedly killed another black kid. But he did. He was there. So he'll be tried in the juvenile court. However, he's going to get a blended sentence, which means you're going to get juvenile life, i.e. you're going to go to a residential facility until you're 21. And at 21, you're going to get out. But the stipulation is that you're still on probation. If you happen to get along get around somebody in your family or friends or whatever and says, hey, I want you to hold this credit card. It turns out to be fraudulent, where they're going to impose the rest of your sentence on you. And I've seen that happen at least 10 times since I've been downtown, which means at 21, let's say you get with the wrong person and now you're 21 and a half, and your initial time frame was 68 years. Well, you're going to get them 68 years. But again, our goal is to save our babies. So with just that background, I want to mention some things, and I also want to call on some of my colleagues as to the things that they remember from medical school and various training, and even some advice from them in terms of when we learned about primary prevention, disease, illness, or whatever we're going to call it. In this case, we're talking about crimes and the judicial system or the criminal justice system. So primary prevention, primarily the goal is to prevent disease or injury before it even occurs. So consider that, man. A lot of us have mentioned different avenues of primary prevention in terms of spending time at home with your children, raising them from birth, celebrating that they can walk, celebrating they start speaking, and you're there. Now, again, consider the internists, the pediatricians on board, you know, how you would implement primary prevention for, well, in this case, COVID or the scheduled vaccines for kids, immunizations, et cetera. But remember, we're trying to prevent primary prevention. We're trying to implement primary prevention for the court system, adjudication, et cetera. Secondary prevention, the goal is to reduce the impact of the primary issue. Let's say here it is, adjudication, 16-year-olds as early as young as 11-year-olds being charged with various crimes and placed in different facilities. How do we implement secondary prevention? Well, some of the examples, say, in regular mainstream medicine would be regular exams, screening, colonoscopies, et cetera, et cetera. But what's the advice in terms of implementing secondary prevention when it comes to our kids who are adjudicated? Tertiary prevention is the goal is to soften the impact of the issue. And in our case, it's crime in our communities, crime against women, kids, et cetera. And this would also include sex trafficking, et cetera. So in part, I'm presenting this as some educational perspective in terms of what goes on downtown in these court systems, but sort of give you guys an idea in terms of what the task is. So with this young man today, you know, kids downtown, they kind of joke about what part of the city they were from. And so he mentions that he's from the east side. And lo and behold, I grew up on the east side. And at the same time, as I'm trying to engage him as to, well, how did you get here? And in between that, I have his attention, yet at the same time, he resorts back to some of the street lingo, street mentality, gang affiliation, et cetera. So, again, as I said, I think my primary goal was to always listen, so I'm listening to this kid. And somehow today we got on the impact of the Ukraine, the situation over in Ukraine. And I jokingly said to him, well, you know, United States, we're at war. And he's thinking about Ukraine, but I'm talking about we're at war in the communities. And I said, well, the president has initiated the draft again, and they're going to start with JDF, meaning that you're going to be drafted and you're going to go fight for freedom. So I want to make sure I wasn't confusing him, and I don't think I was, because he knew exactly what I was talking about as to a scale that I present to all the young men and women when it asks, have you ever been at war? And they all say yes, and they know exactly what I'm talking about in the community. So following that, we started talking about atomic bombs and things like that. And I make the suggestion that the United States is the only country that I know of has ever thrown an atomic bomb on another country, except for the bombing of us in Tulsa, of course. And then I suggested to him, well, you know, there was an atomic bomb thrown on the major cities, and it was called crack cocaine. So, again, I'm trying to engage him on conversation because he's very, very streetwise. Not a lot of book knowledge, not a lot of knowledge about himself. So, again, as to give you just an example of one of the 32 kids we have downtown with all with felony murder charges. Now, imagine how complex it is in engaging this young man because the person he killed undoubtedly looked like me and him. So, again, I want to present this to my colleagues with their knowledge of primary, secondary, and tertiary prevention, how they would proceed and how we all need to proceed in making a difference in these young people's lives. So it's not my presentation is not so much giving specific I guess it is giving some facts of what's going on in these facilities. So I'll just wait and listen to you guys' feedback.
Okay, thank you so much. We're going to ask Dr. Moncrief comments and then Dr. Bowles and Dr. Tynes. So we're going to start with Dr. Moncrief.
Thank you. Again, the conversation has been very, very interesting and stimulating. The examples and the situations that are being presented, you know, would be unbelievable, except they are true. I see 2 points intervention. There's the point where Dr. Longs has an opportunity to intervene with some of these kids before they commit these serious crimes. But there's another place to intervene before a child presents a crime at all, before as they are going through the system. The system is not designed for our children to be successful. Dr. Tynes, you know, gave us a historical perspective of that. But where are we today? What can we do today? And so as our children, for example, enter into school, that K level, first and second grade, what can we do to intervene with our children so to help them make the choice not to commit crimes? I think there's there's still a very, very important role for the church. I think there's a very important role for those groups and extracurricular activities that are outside the schools for our young males and for our females. But we need people to actually go into the schools and help direct our kids. So there's places to intervene early before they make a choice to commit a crime. Kids will be kids. Kids will do things just to do things, okay? And that's not what I'm talking about. Because when our kids get caught just being kids, our kids get put into the judicial system. White kids, they don't. They're just kids being kids. So what can we do to help our kids make choices that will help them not get into our judicial system? Those are my thoughts.
Thank you. Thank you.
Can I respond briefly? Dr. Moncrief, you're right. And one thing I didn't want to present that like there's no hope. There's a lot of hope. Even before I got on the call tonight, I happened to be watching the show with Brian Gumbel on Real Sports. And lo and behold, it had Jalen Rose on there, who probably the young folks may have never heard of, but he does have a sports show on ESPN, but he was a member of the famous Fab Five from the University of Michigan, who were all these young guys who went to the Final Four, et cetera, et cetera. But what he's done, he's used his own money and with the support of some other individuals from Detroit, he's created a school. It's called the Jalen Rose Academy. And if you look at the curriculum, he's doing pretty much what we all realize needs to happen. You know, all of his educators are black. The principal is black, even the security staff are all black, and their curriculum really focuses on improving their knowledge of themselves. It focuses on heavy weight of math. It uses a lot of the things that Dr. Tynes has mentioned in terms of Egyptian studies and all of those sort of things. And so to me, that is an example of, in a way, offering primary, secondary, and tertiary prevention, because he has so many mentors there. He has the Dave Bean program with their youth initiative, and I would also add has a tremendous financial backing as well. So there are some programs in the city. Unfortunately, when I'm engaging these kids, they have no idea what programs used to exist. And that's the major issue right now, just not enough programs.
Okay. Dr. Long, do you ever, do you have children who come from what we might well consider the, a home, a black family who provided the protection, who were there, who provided the education, in the home and in the school, within the school, and the child should not have gone in that direction, but did in spite of their upbringing.
For sure. Ironically, some of the kids who come from those backgrounds are from the homes of law enforcement officers. We've had kids come in there whose parents are doing really well in the city of Detroit as far as setting the new groundwork of the city, and they have tremendous businesses. But, you know, there's this other factor where, let's say, a typical scenario would be this kid is trying to do their best. Now, the parent may have put them in a school outside of the Detroit metropolitan area, you know, a school such as Country Day, which is a very well-to-do school, costs a lot of money to go there. But the kid may have incurred a charge based on CSC, which means criminal sexual misconduct or conduct, based on that environment. So each case is different, but to answer your question, yeah, we do have quite a few kids who come into the system who come from two family backgrounds, professional backgrounds, et cetera, but based on, as we all know, the institutionalized racism, they find themselves in the system anyway. So, yeah, that does happen.
Mm-hmm. Okay, doctor, thank you so much. Dr. Bowles.
Yes, I'm listening intently because I'm not a psychologist, but when I worked in the position of culpability, writing up a medical report from the perspective of adolescent medicine, since I did internal medicine pediatrics or med-ped, I always invoked the adolescent's tendency for impulsivity and seeking peer approval. And in my involvement, I did take some courses on the legal side. Like you, the person who spoke said he's a psychologist, a psychiatrist, and not a lawyer. I wanted to understand the system. And what I found out that I think is very relevant, when a police officer or someone who is arresting a juvenile or whomever, they have an option to register what is happening as a misdemeanor or a felony level charge. I didn't know that. It's all a book of codes. So what I found out as a medical student, there was a white female that was talking, and she was saying what a bad girl she was, how she was a shoplifter, and how she had done something, and she was involved with a situation where there was a knifing. And she finalized her conversation by saying, if my record had not been sealed, I would have not been able to come on and eventually attend medical school. As you know, a professional degree, you can't have a felony, at least that's in most states that I'm aware of. So when I heard this, I turned abruptly and looked at her. And when I began to work in the capacity I've described to you, it was clear that the arresting officers have the option of listing a misdemeanor versus a felony. And in states where they have degrees of murder and a second degree, first degree, or homicide and so forth, the way in which that particular officer writes up the report has very strong bearing on how the district attorney and prosecutor react. So it is not just the figment of imagination when they say black people are treated more harshly. They are treated from the beginning with a felony, a felonious kind of reaction. And whenever there is, let's say, something as heinous as murder or a death in a situation, then if it is a white offender, they start telling you the background, broken home, psychiatric problems, problem with drugs, easily led, mental incompetence. But with the black youth, it is simply, as Hillary Clinton would say, you know, they have a term. They're quick to label them. And the conversation, he's a thug. He's a runaway or the drug addict. You don't get the same compassionate background sourcing. And it was so apparent, if we remember, when the white fellow went into Charleston, South Carolina, and shot all these black people in a church after service, they were quick to start saying how he, the police followed him all the way from South Carolina up through Shelby, North Carolina, and I'm familiar with that area. And then finally, when he's arrested after his heinous crime, they start telling you his background. Or if you look at the Columbine situation where these young people driving a vehicle with no license, stealing the grandparents' guns, they still want to humanize, that's the term I was looking for, any kind of white offender, and they want to brutalize or animalize any black offender. And I'm not really sure how or what we need to do to put a stop to that, but I can tell you that the police officer writing up the incident has a lot of power in how the prosecutor and the DA reacts. I was witness to a neighborhood situation where there is a mother who obviously didn't have, and I say obviously because she's lived next door. I've seen her over 9 years, so this isn't a speculative comment. One of her two sons has been very disrespectful for some time. And then he got to a point one afternoon where he went, I say, berserk. He was hitting things with a baseball bat. He broke out a windshield. He was cursing. He crossed even to my driveway, beating on my door, ringing the doorbell. I didn't respond. So when she called the police and they came, and she was saying, go ahead and take him. I can't handle it. And the police officer said, ma'am, we can't do anything. He hasn't committed a crime. And I'm thinking, okay, where do we get situations to be de-escalated? Why must we wait till there is a killing or a shooting? This mother is obviously in need of help. And she called who is supposed to be the protector, and they stand there and say there's no crime unless she pressed charges that he broke in the windshield of her car, and they wrote it up in such a way that it was not a misdemeanor. No one was going to protect the community from a situation that could have been, in my opinion, decelerated. So my comment for all of this is saying there is no immediate resource at the climax or the necessary time, that 911 is not, and I think in the black communities, should not be the resource we call to. I don't have a paradigm for who I think should show up, but there is a local nonprofit church, and I'll just give them a shout out, Global Impact Ministries, where the minister and his wife and a number of his deacons do just that. When there is a crisis, their parishioners have been told, call one of these, what they call street deacons, and mm-hmm. the street deacons will try to decelerate a situation before 911 gets called. Or if 911's on the scene, they still show up. And this particular church, the minister has a wonderful rapport with the Ninth Circuit Court, and he often goes in and sits among the young offenders and so forth. So there are potential solutions, but it has to be outside of what is the white American DOJ, because white people get their adolescent records sealed, and they get on mm-hmm. with their life. And as you right. pointed out, young people live under the threat of a probation that can send them back to prison for the rest of their life. So I think it's a community thing, think outside the box. And when we say we don't know what to do, I'm saying it's because we haven't stopped to see what an immediate solution could be.
That's excellent. Thank you so very much. I could say a lot on that, but I'm going to let Dr. Tynes chime in, and I'm certain Dr. Tynes will probably say everything that I would to Tynes.
Thank you. No, what I would say is that you can't use the same problem you can't use the problem that caused the problem. You can't use the solution. So I'm misquoting.
The problem as the solution.
Well, so I'll have to paraphrase it, and I was giving honor to Dr. Bowles, but.
Yes.
What we do is that we take the same thing that caused the problem and try to use that as a solution. And
mm-hmm.
but what I have to also thank about what they were saying is that we have to start a shake up and a wake up. We have to mm-hmm. start a shake up and a wake up, and we have to realize in order for us to move forward to save our children, we have to take onus of our mistakes, our shortcomings, our insecurities, our miseducation. We cannot deny that we were miseducated. You can't solve a problem with the same solution that caused the problem. That's Dr. Zelma Bowles, MD, MedPeds, quoting her correctly. We don't want to call out FBI informants. So, for instance, which is a fact, FBI informant Jesse Jackson, fact. FBI informant Al Sharpton, fact. Gene Roberts, FBI informant, facts. William, the one who set up Fred Hampton. You know, we have our people who have been injured mentally that go against us and therefore go against our children. And what Michael Tanger said before, we have to stop trying to include people who don't see themselves as us, don't want to belong to us. We cannot force goats to be sheep, because the goat is always going to say butt, and the goat is always going to butt heads. So what we have to do is we have to regain the trust of our young people. Dr. Lawrence has shown that how we do that is first listening to them. I'm going to tell you, they talk like they text. So you have to spend time and let them get it out. Then you will see it. And then you will learn how to do short phrases to communicate with them in their little concrete reality. So we have to learn that we don't have the solution. We don't have the answers. We are not the guides or the mentors to these children. Let me repeat that. We are not the guides or the mentors to these children, because you cannot mentor what you know nothing about. You can't guide where you don't know where you're going. So because we do not know where we're going, we cannot guide them. And because we cannot mentor them, because we were not properly mentored. But as a child, you know, I was little when Malcolm X was killed. But the thing that impacted me was the people around me back then made him my spiritual. He became my spiritual father and that role model, which helped me come through Harlem, which helped me come to three gums to my head at different times, being stabbed, being sliced with a knife, being burnt, being hit with a pipe. So I came through that from Harlem to doctor because of the image of Malcolm X, the image of some of the black community leaders who were not political leaders, but guys in the neighborhood looking out for the young fellas that we looked up to because of either how they talked and their wisdom or their basketball playing. We don't have a refuge for our children. We don't have the barbershops where they make them hang out and hear some wise people talk. What we have talking is niggas. We have niggas talking about tequilas, about going to the club, about doing this with the girl or that with the girl, that kind of stuff. That's what we have in terms of coaches on basketball teams, on football teams, on baseball teams. That's what we have, is that the niggas are the ones who are leading and guiding our children. So how can we expect differently? All we have is Grand Theft Auto. We have Fortnite. We have all of this white media telling these things. And here we are trying to work in the context of a white society that's killing us instead of a black reality. Like, where is our Marcus Garvey? Where is our Carter G. Woodson? Where is our Frederick Douglass? Where is our Queen Mother Moore? So we have to do the reality. Dr. Long told you one time that a kid on death who's a prisoner had a transformative moment when he actually saw a picture of a black Jesus. Because up until that time, if Jesus could be black, that was value. But 90%, I'm a pastor, 90% or greater of all black pastors subconsciously and consciously have a white Jesus. And that's a mental disease, a schizophrenic disease. when your God does not look like you, that's a schizophrenia. That's a mental illness. So we have to understand that we're sick. And because we're sick, our children are sick. So we have to understand that the treatment is for us and our children. We have to fight with ourselves and look in that mirror and start loving our black selves. Most black people, and I'm going to say everybody on this radio show, have moments, and some of us who cannot even identify with Africa still have mental illness in terms of that has been injected in us through our culture and our society. If you cannot be unapologetically black, unapologetically African, and unshamefully pro-black, then you have an injury, you have an illness that you have to work on. Because every single race on the planet, every single ethnic group identifies themselves by their race, by their culture, by their history. We are the only race separated from the African that always put the white race first. And that's how you know that blacks are injured. Anytime a black says everybody and anybody want to include people, that is a dysfunctional, injured black person, no matter what their age. Any of them who look to help other groups is injured, because the first thing is self-preservation and survival. No lion goes out trying to help a hyena, period. So that's what we have to look at, that we are not looking for ourselves. And when our children see that we love being black and we could draw them in, remember the 40s, the 50s, the 60s, all of those movements centered around blackness. Even Dr. Martin Luther King said that he was black, he was beautiful, he was proud, but you don't hear them teaching that. They don't teach you that the black pastors turned their back on Dr. Martin Luther King after Malcolm X was killed and King became a human rights activist and was no longer a civil rights activist because you was already pushing the civil rights bill. They want to tell you that the black church betrayed the black community, and they do it now. The black church is an enemy to the black community unless they're separated, because the black church has now received funding from George Bush, and we are called the faith-based initiative. We are called the faith-based initiative. In other words, we are the FBI in your community, that we are the FBI in your community working to keep you enslaved mentally and keep you enslaved culturally, because if you're not promoting a black Jesus, a black Christ coming out of North Africa, then what you're doing is you're promoting a people who adopted the religion and use it to enslave you mentally, physically, culturally, and spiritually. So that's what we have to see. I can relate to all kids because I come with them spiritually, and their God, their heroes look like them. That means it uplifts their self-esteem. When you have to struggle with that as an adult, from what I just said, that's troubling, it's troublesome to you. That means the problem is you, not the children around you. So all I'm saying, we have to look at what pulled us together before. In the 50s, 40s, 60s, we generated around our black history, our blackness, our black hair, our black skin, our black lips, our black hips. We were uplifting. And it was the whites who came in with the negative rap and ghetto rap that got us here. We have to put our money in our cartoons. We got to put our money in our comic books. We have to put our money. It should be mandatory that everybody owns the Black Panther with Chadwick Boseman, and we have to make those kids look at that, because we got to get some stuff subconsciously in their minds, which is pro-black. And we have to put that in us, pro-black. We have to start changing what we do. And I'll end with this. We have to give up white milk and start drinking chocolate milk.
I totally agree. Totally agree. And I just want to comment while I'm asking. I'm asking Byron, I would really like for you to respond to this, to these past few comments. And the faith-based initiatives. Now, these are, for those who don't understand, this is a program, it's a project right from the White House. And it's been on the books for years, where they providing funding you know, for various different types of projects and programs and, you know, in the Black community. And certain people, certain projects, they've been Black are receiving those. And certain other people,
Dr. Lee, just be truthful. Stop trying to be clean. Bottom line, faith-based initiative is that the federal government gives us Black pastors, Black churches monies to make sure that we politically influence you in the direction in terms of the Democrat, and in particular, that we try to influence you so that you don't have protests, that you maybe have marches and demonstrations, but you won't have aggressiveness. That's money paid to the churches, paid to the pastors. That's what the faith-based initiative, the FBI, used to be FBI, Federal Bureau of Investigation, and then in the 50s it became Find Blacks and Incarcerate, and then George Bush took it up to George Bush took it to where the pastors became the FBI for the community to keep us in check and make sure that we don't do what we did in the 60s and 70s in terms of uprising.
Mm-hmm.
So it's us pastors. I'm Reverend Dr. Simons.
Right.
Okay.
Right. I'm definitely not trying to keep it clean. I was just kind of like working up to it. So to get to the point that I want to make is that these funds are provided with stipulations and guidelines that our people, our faith-based or churches and pastors, it's incorporated inside of their contract, but they're not required. These same verbiages are not required in a white church or you know, faith-based or whatever contract. So they're requiring certain, they're written differently. And so because, you know, our churches and certain leaders, money is more important than us, you know, than their own people, you know, community. And so that was where I was actually trying to get to, is that it's
they
literally.
They pay us $10,000 a month. They'll pay us $10,000 a month to hold a vaccine clinic. They will pay the church $10,000 a month to host a vaccine clinic, but they won't promote treatment. Even though we got treatment, monoclonal antibody treatment versus IV, they won't. So the pastor makes money off of holding these vaccines, and the Pfizer is only 42% effective, and that's one of the main ones that they promote. Moderna was 76%. They won't let you use the Novavax, which is actually the best. That's basically dead virus. So, yes, they're paying the pastors to keep you under control. They're paying the pastors to vaccinate you. That's why they offered you marijuana. That's why they offered you chicken dinners. That's why they offered you lottery tickets. That's why they did lottery tickets. Oh, they offered you beer. Yeah, so. You know, so we, all of us old enough, we know pimp when we see it and we hear it.
Well, this is Dr. Bowles, and if I may chime in, I was very much at the head of the COVID-19 position 2 years ago when Joe Biden was supposed to be setting up his COVID-19 panel. I was desperately trying to get on that panel. I was trying to get a consulate to travel to Washington to talk to them. As you know, that New Orleans, Detroit, Chicago was having disproportionate death of Black people because first time in the history of medicine, the health care people were telling you what symptoms you had to have in order to be designated to have a disease. And anyone trained in health care, nursing, CNAs, not just MDs, we know we listen to the patient about their symptom in order to diagnose the disease. And if you, everyone stop for a moment and consider, that wasn't what it was. If you didn't have a cough or a fever in January 2020, they turned you away. And I knew people turned away up to 5 times from the emergency room in New Orleans because they didn't have the designated symptoms. Why am I saying all this? because absolutely true. The major churches, particularly in Alexandria, Louisiana, and other places, were paying people up to a $200 charge card to come and get a vaccine. And I was shouting up and down on every radio, television program I could get on, saying, black folk, if you have diabetes, renal failure, any kind of, as they say, comorbidity, ask for monoclonal antibodies. You can be protected that way. I also was advocating the vitamin D, my vitamin D3. I was advocating vitamin C. YouTube sent me a message when I did a radio interview saying, we are screening tightly for misinformation, and we wanted to make you aware because you've had two broadcasts within the last 2 weeks to be posted. I'm saying, what is that, a warning? So you're absolutely right. We are being watched, and even when black try to help black know the right path, we can be curtailed because there is no broadcast system that's black-owned. YouTube can shut you down. Any kind of television studio can edit you out. So it's very difficult when you're in the fight and trying to do the best thing and not have the resources that can support that effort. So I beg your pardon for that interruption, but when you said that, I said, I know I've been in this fight for COVID-19 and the black people particularly for now 2 years.
So very much, and that's fine to interject. And we have Dr. Tynes and I and, you know, others, you know, we have asked for treatment. I mean, I personally went through this. And where, you know, we fought for treatment, and they refused to treat. They refused to treat. They refused to give the monoclonal. They refused to even give the right type, any type of medication to
our
people.
Well, that's because the American Medical Association threatened licenses. See, this is what I mean by we don't have the clout. That if you're told you're working in a hospital that if you give ivermectin, you will be fired, or if you have a contract, they say your contract will be canceled. That tied the hands of many black physicians who are in positions in white hospitals, and most of the big hospitals are white-owned. I don't really know, and someone could educate me, if there is even a black-owned facilities in the United States. So the hands were tied because our professional licensing is not something we own. We have to be approved by a state, and they can simply say, oh, ethically, we have violated your license. You're suspended, or you can't practice in this state. So we are handcuffed. Even when we know medically better, we can't, you know, take care of our family and take care of, you know, due diligence to our racial group. So it's really a handicap in our not having ownership.
Right, exactly. And that's what we are working on. It's building our own communities and owning our own hospitals and medical centers and stores, as someone has said earlier. So thank you so much. I want to turn to our youth on here. Byron, we want to hear from you. Byron?
Yes, ma'am.
Okay, there you are. Yeah. So your thoughts and, you know, your challenges, you know, we really want to hear from our young people. You know, we want to know your feelings, your heart, you know, what you think we should be doing. And you know, we want you to tell us. Go ahead.
Well, what I do, I remember last week, a young brother, he did a spoken word, so I'm going to, I guess I'll do the same thing. A spoken word piece that I wrote, and it's entitled Being Black in America. I'll do this piece in that same regard. The same nation that had us singing My Country, Tis of Thee is the same nation that kills men, women, boys, and girls that look like me. being black in America. For the past few years, all I heard was America screaming about again making it great. And to that notion, I beg the questions, my brothers and sisters, when was our country truly and ethically great? Was it during the time when my people were beaten, enslaved, and raped, being black in America? Was it when racist white men filled with hatred burned crosses and lynched black and brown Americans, all while wearing a cross around their necks and a white sheet across their face, being black in America? Was it when Emmett Till was killed based on a white lie, or when the white woman who admitted she lied was never tried, being black in America? We call this nation the land of the free, and I guess that's true. Well, as long as your skin lacks melanin and your eyes are deep blue, being black in America is knowing that if I were ever to step foot ready to riot on Capitol Hill, I'd be tear gas shot and most definitely killed. Yet armed domestic terrorists rioted, stormed, and looted the building without worry or consequence, all because they had white privilege as their shield. Being black in America means that I could be murdered by a white man just for jogging in the street. Being black in America means that I could be killed by police right inside my own home as I sleep. This is swift for everyone except for me. Being black in America is full of wonderful culture and flavor. Being black in America is constantly reminding our justice system of the injustice that remains in the murder of Breonna Taylor. Being black in America will no longer be a death sentence for my future children, because enough is enough, and I will continue to fight as long as the blood within my veins and the Lord Almighty keeps me living. Being black in America means taking a stand. Being black in America is showing our oppressors that told us we could and that, yes, we most definitely can. On July 23rd, 1963, in the great city of Detroit, Dr. King for the first time uttered the words of his dream. And as a black man in America today from the city of Detroit, I do decree that being black in America will break the shackles of power, privilege, and oppression and finally allow true freedom to reign. Being black in America will show our kids that we truly come from kings and queens. Being black in America will remove from our society racism and hatred's horrible sting. Being black in America will ensure that all people, no matter the color of their skin or the place of their origin, will all be able to live out their American dream, being black in America.
And that's all I have to say is that piece that I wrote.
Wow. Thank you. Thank you. You said it. You said it. And thank you for it. And this is what we want. We want to hear from our youth, our young people. And I appreciate that so very much. You're always welcome here, always welcome to come to speak your heart, your mind, express yourself any, you know, way you choose. Thank you. Thank you. Trace.
Yes, I'm here.
Your response to the last to our doctors and adults, we want to hear what you have to say. Just what your heart feels and thinks.
Yeah, my take is it's very sad, you know, just the state of where we're at. I'm just thinking about the changes that could be made. Being black in America is it surely does. It comes with the struggles, especially with myself. I do a lot of work in predominantly white environments, and oftentimes I'm the only black person. So it comes with a certain mindset and a certain amount of subliminal pressure, where you don't want to be, you know, I guess too black, or you don't want to be too white, or you don't want to be. You kind of have to have a healthy balance, and that's just with the. I want to say, we'll say corporate view, corporate world, and having that knowledge and being grounded and knowing the history and what we've gone through from post-traumatic slave syndrome. There's a lot of things. It's very difficult. It's hard. It's a lot to process, and it's hard to fully come up with one set resolution or one set answer. All I know is that for black people, we have a lot of work to do. We have ways to go, but we're at the right place right now. Us being here now, well, this is a great focal point for any type of audience, from hearing elders agree and disagree respectfully, this shows us young people, this is how you do it. We can also disagree. I know earlier it was mentioned that, you know, at what limit are we going to start de-escalating situations to have de-escalating skills? These are all things that we have to set up things within our community. And we have to prioritize our knowledge and insight. We have to prioritize our literacy of history, our financial literacy, our camaraderie. And so this is a perfect place for that. So I've really just been taking everything in and listening. I'm just thankful for the perspectives and the chance to learn from a lot of unique, high-class thinkers.
Thank you so much. And would you share with us your job so that you know, our colleagues and listening audience can understand what type of work you do. And I do want you all to listen carefully, because we as a people, I mean, Trace is in a position, place where he takes care of his siblings. And he has for a number of years since the death of his. So he has to have an income. And, you know, after you share, you know, where you work, I think I would like for Dr. Long to respond.
Okay, yeah. So I work with I do news. My specialty is news. I'm a photojournalist / MMJ, aka a multimedia journalist. So a multimedia journalist could cover news, sports, weather. We're pretty much the front runners of a lot of things, and a photojournalist is someone who goes out, does live shots. I deliver pretty much all the news to our station. And so, that's what I do. And also opportunities to do fill-in anchoring, news anchoring and stuff. And there's not a lot of white people in the city that I'm at my news station, which is WTHI News 10. You know, naturally it's in Terre Haute, Indiana, which is definitely predominantly white, smaller city. But I love television because it just gives me a platform for many people, for minorities. It gives me a platform for people who don't have the spotlight to voice out things. So I'm in a very pivotal and impactful position to impact and inspire. I keep a healthy relationship with the local universities, Indiana State, Rose Holman, St. Mary of the Woods, even Ivy Tech. I keep good connection with all these places because everybody that goes through those doors has a story. And so it's my job to give out that platform. And also with that, what I've discovered is that as black people, you know, they teach me how to do news. They teach you what to do to get on air. They teach you everything, but everything that they teach you is how to work. They don't teach you how to own. I've never been taught what it takes to own a TV station. I've never been taught to operate a black media or operate my own media. So all the work I'm doing for the company, I could be doing for myself and educating our community of how they can educate themselves and how we can own. There's in Indiana, there's only one major black television owner, which is in Indianapolis, Wish TV, which is owned by DeJob McCoy, who I was gifted the lovely opportunity to meet and network with. But that's just the only black television owner that I know. And with that, he has his own responsibilities and obligations to fulfill. And so it just makes me think about how us as black people, we have to invest in our financial literacy. We have to. It's mandatory. We have to put a demand on knowing how to keep money within our community, you know, or just even how to earn money without having to clock in for the next man, for somebody else. So the checks that I'm getting, you know, they're from, you know, the owners essentially. But the owners are no people that are black. They're not black. We know that. And so it comes down to how could we be in the position as people, or how could myself be in a position to own, to elevate, so we can show other black people that they too can own, and here's how. There's things that we're not learning that we could and we should, but we're not. So being financially literate, hence why on top of my career, I have a mentor who teaches me real estate investing, owning land, getting back to the roots and foundations of ownership. And so with that, you could work your day job, work your regular job, and also have other income coming in on the side. And so that comes down to financial literacy. And these are things that I think in the Black community we need to really be on, because once we elevate our way of thinking and the way you don't have to necessarily work to get a paycheck. Once we understand that, we're able to make an impact. And so I use my life and my platforms and my gifts to really shine a light on the things I'm telling you, local events, you know, national events, sporting events. You know, I like to stay a student to it all. So, yes, to answer the question, where do I work and what do I do? News 10, you guys could find me on LinkedIn, or you could look me up, Google me or something, and you'll see results.
Thank you. Thank you so much. Okay. So, so we just heard where he works and who it's owned by. Now, I appreciate him joining us on this platform, which is completely, totally different. And so, Dr. Long, you know, when you have a person, you know, with the heart that Trace has, and you're between got to earn a paycheck and then to be, you know, on a station that's all Black, you know, doing essentially almost the same thing. You know, could you speak to maybe challenges or, you know, being on these two different types of platforms, one paying and the other one not, but then maybe more, a little bit more freer on one? You know, we're always in these types of positions. And can you, if you just explain, you know, what type of situation this here is?
Again, thanks, Dr. Mary Lee. And again, I want to congratulate Trace on his accomplishments. And as he was speaking, you know, I was imagining him with me downtown, engaging our youth who are you know, currently adjudicated and behind bars, and imagining his outreach to them. And, you know, he's not too older than most of them. And it also had me, it reminded me of when we had Michael Tynes present his theory on systemic dopes, and we did this program together, and I remember taping what he said, and I brought that image with me downtown, and it was just interesting as these had in my office at the time, six young guys, I was just watching how they were examining Michael. I can't say they were listening. They were examining him. And again, it just reinforced the challenge that we have with ourselves, really, such that, you know, Michael, Chase, and Trace and others who have stayed clear of all the pitfalls that America presents, but I do believe that they would have a challenge in engaging our youth downtown. Now, speaking to how do you balance two different roles, you know, of course you want to maintain who you are and your identity. So with that, you know, Dr. Lee, I've mentioned one of my clients, active, and perhaps even Trace can speak to this situation where you have the National Football League, 85% Black, and no ownership. We have a few general managers, Chris Greer, who happens to be my old high school football coach's son. So, of course, Coach Bobby Greer raises sons to have positions of significance and control and power, yet Chris Greer doesn't own the Miami Dolphins. I think we have our general manager here in Detroit. they have a 95% league, and my client is dealing with that league now. You know, to hear him dispel whatever we think about professional athletes and how much money they make, when I listen to him, I hear nothing but plantation 101 or 201. So, you know, I congratulate his accomplishments and the fact that he has that background and that, you know, he's planted in the truth and his spiritual beliefs, et cetera, which are great. But, again, I find it, and I would ask him and the other young people on the line, how would they engage people who, I'll tell you, they think they are in ownership because they own the streets. You know, they're rolling blocks, guns, women, and drugs, and it's hard to convince them that they don't own anything and that streets are true. The streets are honest. It's full of potholes and other sort of things out there for you to easily get caught up in. So as Dr. Mm-hmm. Tynes and others said, you know, we need to step back and let our youth speak. I agree, but I still believe it would be a challenge for them in engaging their own the individuals within their own age distribution. So, you know, it seems like Trace and others have a pretty good idea of how to balance these things and how to proceed through life while having earned, in the words of an old professor from U of M, Dr. Lockhart, after having learned your honorary white degrees. So that would be my comment. I'm sorry.
Okay. Thank you so very much. Dr. Tynes.
Yes, ma'am.
What do you have to say about this challenge? I mean, do you feel challenged here working, you know, for...
So Dr. Longs is 100% correct. And what I was, that's why I've been beating up on the elders is that, because from our shows from before, they're thinking that they can come in and they think they could mentor the stuff. And here's Michael, who spoke to the juvenile system, people, you know, his own age and talked to the whole high school, Benton Harbor High School. And the in their second, even their academy, and what Dr. Longs was saying is that then they have to analyze him because he looks like them, but he don't talk like them. But he looks like them, has a swag like them, but you know he talking some stuff, and they said it that they never heard before, because the adults had never taught him. Mike was teaching correct Black history going back 30,000 BC. And bringing it up. And so, and Dr. Long will tell you that he was telling a young man, you know, information, but the young man had, it wasn't presented in the rap form or the text form that he was accustomed to, so he brought that to Dr. Long so he could say that this is how I hear it. I hear what you're saying, that old school, old way, it's not registering with me, but this guy is saying it, the same thing, the concept that you're saying, in a way that I can understand. And so that's why it has to be the youth, and that's why I'm saying we as council, but we have to get off a high horse and thinking who we are and thinking what our status in society is and that kind of stuff, who we're related to and all that crap, because the death count is too high. It's too serious. So what we have to look at is that most of the Black role models are Oreos. And the young people, an Oreo cookie is black on the outside, white on the inside. Dr. Balls tell you that. And these are the same ones that inappropriate behavior where they hurt ourselves. And what I'm realizing is that I have white staff, and they, you know, they be saying, oh, you're amazing and all that stuff. But I'm 100% black 24/7. They get along with me because they dealt with that reality, and so here it is for them. Shoot, I'm a hero and all this stuff, and I'm cool. But other white doctors have problems. Other white professionals have problems. I treat everybody the same, black, white, Asian, but I just don't have low self-esteem. I just don't. I know my place in their history. I know when I say Okin Kadeska, which is Japanese, that I know that Sanko no Tomoto was the first shogun, samurai of Japan, black man. I know if I say Kongbonwa, Nihoma, that I know that Fuxi was one of the first emperors of China, black man, created the fish nest ceremonies. I know that. I know if I go into, if I go over into India, I know that Krishna means the black one, and he was a virgin black skin. So their primary god, there was, and that the early Indians were called Dravidians, or were all black skin. And that I know that that black skin, we know that because the Indians used to tan with tanning lotion to make their babies black. And that's what we got the whole thing about using tanning oil to darken the skin. So I know if I go over Assalamu Alaikum, if I go into the Arab world, not only did I know that Muhammad had an uncle who was Ethiopian, not only did I know that it was Bilal who wrote the first part of the Quran for the Prophet because he could not read or write. So I know my place in their history. I know when I go into Germany and I say Guten Tag, that I know that that we have Beethoven over there. I know if I go to Russia and I say Skravas Yes, and I know that he's the father of Russian literature. The Russians were talking French until he created the Russian language. So I know my place. I know my place in history. I know in America that we have the Fosan people, who are the first people here, who were the black people that the Alaskans intermarried with to get what you call the Native American of today. So I know my history. I know that the Olmec Empire set up what we call the Incas and the Mayas. And the Incas and the Mayas told you that they didn't build those pyramids. It was those Africans that came before them. So I know my place in my history. And so when I know my history, I know my greatness. And so that's how I walk around with my head up proud. And what happens is if you have a problem, if you're white, if you're Hispanic, if you're Arab, that problem has to do with you, not dealing with me, because I know my place. And so the problem is we don't know our place, and that we have to give that back to our children so that our children can walk up tall and proud and not look to the TV world and the media world to find some identity, and that we pretend that it's not going on. Because I remember I taught black history at Wayne State one summer, and the guy said he was mad for almost 2 years, a kid, once he found out he had been lied to. And then I realized I had to do it a little bit differently and bringing them up slowly. So we both have the learning experience. We both have to meet each other. So the adults and the children and the youth and the infants, we have to meet each other because they're killing each other. See, we're killing each other because we don't have an identity or love for each other, because we are not human beings. We're nobodies trying to be somebody. But once we learn the truth that we are the somebodies that made everybody a somebody, that there is no race on the planet, there is no civilization on the planet that did not have an African presence to start it. No place on this planet did not start without an African influence. And because of that jealousy and envy, they hate us and want to kill us. But we have to restore that our identity to ourselves so we can share that with our children, so that way they can say, when they know their history, they know their greatness. And like my six-year-old daughter said, I make no apologies for my greatness. So we have to restore that. And our kids don't have a full sense of standing tall based on their history. They just want to stand tall and fit into this white man world. But they didn't know that the white man had to imitate the black man, that the first educated white man ever in history, the first educated white man ever in history was named Thales, T-H-A-L-E-S. He was the first educated white man, and he had to learn from the Africans. So the blacks were the educators all. And he paid for the education of Pythagoras, the third white man to be educated in history. And Pythagoras set up a medical school on the island of Kos off of Greece, where a white dude took Egyptian writing, African writing, and translated into Greek and became their Western father of medicine named Hippocrates. So we have to know our place in history so it's not a mystery.
Thank you. Thank you so very much. Okay, we're winding it up. I do want to ask if any of our listening audience, if you have a question or comment, this is your time. Just press one, tap one on your phone, and we will answer your question before we wind it up. So as we're winding it down, we're going to get our final thoughts and from each one. So, Dr. Tyne, since you are speaking, we'll let you give your final remarks, final thoughts. Or
my final thoughts is that young people, and I know we have some other young people who are listening, and you don't have to talk fluid like these other young people that you hear. We want to hear you talk like you, and that's okay, because I know you guys are on the phone, and that's fine. And so next time, we want you to say, to lead a little bit. I know it doesn't matter that you guys have been to jail, probation, you know, those kind of
right.
things. That doesn't matter to us. So even
right,
though
right.
you're listening, you're the stars. You're the reason why we're here. You're the reason
yeah.
why we're going through this because you have the answers. You're the key. You're the ones who've been harassed by the cops or locked up by the cops, beat up by the cops. You're the ones who mamas had to have you sell some marijuana or some weed. You're the ones who brothers had to go to jail for being accomplice to a murder. So I know I'm putting your business out there because to let you know it's all cool. This is a safe environment for you. So you can speak if you want to speak tonight, fine. Next time we speak, you can speak. But you're the stars of this show. You are heroes because you are the young people who are still surviving, still alive, and have enough in you to actually want to hear the stuff that we're saying tonight. So I'm thanking you, and we appreciate you, and we want you to take the lead.
Yeah.
We want you to speak because you're so important. And you don't have – so it doesn't matter if you didn't finish high school. That don't mean a thing. It don't matter if you got a felony. It don't mean a thing. But you
right.
are the main reason we are here tonight. You are the reason that we want to fight. But we want to fight in the areas that you need us to fight, not what we think we should fight. We want us to fight with you, beside you, to help you, to guide you. You see, because we're going to work with you, not try to lead you, but we're just going to try not to guide you, but to work with you so that you don't fall into the pitfalls that we went into, but you can give us a new direction, a new reality. So y'all are listening. I thank y'all for getting on this line, but it's your time. It's your time. If not tonight, but the next time, we want you to speak. And I'm going to talk with y'all after, you know, during this week and coming, that we want you to speak. And Dr. Mary Lee is going to let you know that it's all right for you to speak. And that's what Dr. Bowles, Dr. Moncrief, Dr. Long, all of us want to hear from you. You come from
yeah.
greatness. You are greatness. You're the situation does not determine or limit your destination. And your destination is greatness. So I want you to know that, and that we believe in you, and that we love you, and that we care about you.
Thank you so very much. And yes, I did all that, and, you know, 100 times more. So please come back, invite your friends, and Dr. Tyne just said it all. So this is why we're here. This is why we have this program going, Saving Our Babies, because this is what we genuinely here to do. And then I also want to ask our listening audience and, you know, all our friends and family to invite your family, your youth, your young people. We want to hear from them. You know, let them know that this is a safe. Appreciate you very much. Dr. Bowes, this is for final thoughts and remarks and comments.
Well, this has been most interesting, and I first want to echo the invitation for young people to get their voice, however, whatever your voice is. It's always good to hear spoken word, but I'm interested in whatever other type of communications that you have, because I enjoy hearing the perspective of younger people. It helped keep me young, so you're doing me a favor. I'm doing this for personal gain to hear what you have to say. I did want to share one story in hearing the comment of the previous professional talking about having office personnel comment on what he does as if that were necessary. I want the young people to know just because you have a professional position or you may have what looks like the best job, when it comes down to it, when people are impacted by your color, and if there's young ladies who've also had the double jeopardy of the black and female prejudicial behavior, I was a medical director for some years, and I had quite a staff, and I felt like we were a great team, and we certainly worked well. And someone came to my office and told me one of the personnel's daughter was getting married. Well, as director, I knew her circumstance. They didn't have a lot of money. The person was a hard worker. And I signed the card, you know, best wishes, and I put some money in the card. And about 2 hours later, the person who had come around to get signatures was standing at my door, and she was kind of sheepish. And I said, yes. She said, Dr. Bowles, I have to give you your money back. I said, what? She said, you're not invited to the wedding. And I didn't know quite what to do. I smiled and said, okay, and I wondered if I needed to take my signature or my best wishes off of the card. The bottom line was this person who, as I said, wasn't in the highest socioeconomic level, meaning she didn't make much money, and I knew how much she made. I knew her circumstance, but she still felt better than me because I'm black, and the wedding that she intended for her daughter was not to include black people. So that comment is to say we never get away from our blackness in the United States of America. And despite you know, all kinds of FBI surveillances and the unified faith-based stuff where they're paying who we would hope to be our leaders and confidants to not give us the best advice, I hope that the young people realize there are still a few of us, and I count myself among them, that I tell you, if I cannot tell you what is truth, I will tell you nothing at all. So I take a pledge that if my help is needed and I commit to do it, it will be done to the best of my ability, and if I don't know, I'll help you seek the truth. So I enjoy these three sessions, and I most anxiously await to hear from more young people.
Thank you, thank you, thank you, and welcome to our team. Okay, I appreciate it so much. Dr. Long, our wrap-up.
Again, thank you, Dr. Mary Lee, and I want to thank all the listeners for listening and everyone who contributed. But most of all, I want to you know, offer an apology to our young people in general for us not protecting you guys from all the horrors, you know, of this false narrative that we all find ourselves in the United States. Yet the conclusion that I want to leave is that trying to revert all of that in terms of what we've been exposed to, I do believe it's all of our responsibility, but at this point, they're the leaders. So again, I applaud them for all their accomplishments and having to deal with all the horrors that we've dealt with. But again, apologize for that. We didn't protect them from that. But we can still make it happen. That's my final comment.
Thank you. We do have a question or a comment from error code
470-7329. Yes.
And then following. Okay, you're live.
Okay. It's Revelation.
Hello.
How you all doing? Hello, Dr.
Lee. Hello, welcome.
Thank you all for welcoming me, and thank you for welcoming me as well, Angel. I saw back again, and I listened to everything, you know, that was said. And, you know, to be able to fight any war, it have to be, you know, spiritually, mentally, and physically, and financially stable. Even, you know, the presidents and whoever throughout the United States, any position that they ever had, that person had to be more likely first, you know, financially stable to be able to win that competition. Because in America, you know, it's a collateral type of thing that goes on. No matter where or, you know, who it is throughout America. And you all have to, we all have to realize and know, you know, that that's a factor. No matter what you want to say, no matter how you want to look at it, it's all boils down to those things, to those type of people that, you know, material things matter too. Now, when it comes to saving a nation and or masses of people throughout the whole world, starting with our own backyards and things like that first, you know, wherever you at in whatever city that you at, we have to listen and pay attention to one another. If you want to, you know, save tribes, starting with babies, and because you raise a baby up in the way it should go, which take leadership, because no baby knows what to do, how to talk, how to walk, how to crawl, whatever, how to crawl, how to walk, how to talk, however way you want to put, unless it's talk first. And so, you know, and the et ceteras that go with it, you have to install different type of trainings as you teach that child those things as it grow, because we all came from a seed and we all are trees, so we all gonna grow. You know, some more younger than the older, some more older than the younger, but we all are witnessing what's going on in America and throughout the world, because when we say black, we just not talking about one culture. We have black people that's being disowned as Mexican. We have black people that's being disowned as Cubans, Chinese, you know, Chinese men and women. It's different blacks that's being mistreated worldwide than one section. So we all have to look at these things. Then we all have to get all the bills that's not even in place that these people say that's in order behind those big walls. Because I done been in so big buildings, so big, you don't even know who behind the walls. But it's somebody behind there listening and typing. So I've been in many type of meetings. And I've been in many different places to hear and see different things as well. Especially on a political and revolutionary level, when the government always follow you, from the CIA to the FBI to the regular street police, the city, the state, the county, all different things, all different types of organizations that have, you know, taken place in my life and that I witnessed and that I helped other young people conquer. Because those things are preventable to when you want to, you know, win a spiritual, mental, or physical war. You have to train those children up in a way that they should go, because they don't know. As we all have heard tonight, the courthouses and the judges that's against all children, they was against me. So I know what I know what I'm talking about. I ain't just talking and then live it. Like I mentioned before, I'm not going to ever bring nothing to the table that, you know, I haven't endured myself, and or I'm not going to ever say nothing that I haven't experienced myself, because I got the scars to prove that I'm me, because that come along with it too. So don't forget that, because you're going to get bruised up, shot, beat up, whatever, because that's in the memo. When you're talking about leading, those things come with it. So you can't get one bruise and say, okay, I'll quit. I confine to what you say. No, ain't none of that. Ain't none of that. Not when you want to win. Do you really want to win? Because if you do, then those documentations have to be just slung out there. It have to be signed in order. We have to have a team, that straight legal firm, go in there, type this up. We fit to create laws, okay? When we want this city, okay, well, we fit to do this over here in this city. We fit to go ahead and send the laws to the legislators, you know what I'm saying, executive, judicial branches, to get it all the way up to the Supreme Courts. You see what I'm saying? So we have to set those things and those means and those documentation, because that's what they live by. It's black and white, ain't it? You see what I'm saying? So we have to set that. Then have a financial institution over here to support the laws that we push. Because finances have to be behind it. You see what I'm saying? So it just can't be talk. It has to be action after the talking. It always have to be action after the talking. It just can't be talk and an idea. Because we all are together. No one here is an enemy of no one, and or should not be. If we talking about coming together, that shouldn't even be a thought, because you can't go into something with a hardened heart and expect greatness. You can't have a hardened heart towards someone and expect to win. You have to be humble. Humble as you can be. Or humble as possible as you can be, you know. And I really didn't have a question, you know. I just wanted to state facts on things, you know, and say that I'm proud of all the young people and all the older elder people and people of my age as well, you know, because it's wonderful to hear the enlightenment. It's always wonderful to light a wick and watch the candle burn, the light that danced off inside the glass, you know, sparking the burn that can change the nation. It just feels great, you know, to sit back and watch and see. And then you see how it grows. Once trained in water, once you pour love and everything that's essential to growth, spiritually, mentally, physically, financially, you know, all around the board, you know. And if these programs are in place, then let's place them around what's really needed and what's really need to be done to support what the talking is about, you know. And because to beat these people at their own games is just a white document. And the finances that go behind it. And if you're a businessman or woman, you know that. Why you think it's institutes? Why you think they got them things? Documentation and finances. You know. So
we certainly appreciate. We certainly appreciate you.
Yes, ma'am.
We certainly appreciate you joining us. And
yeah, I won't try to take up all the time, and I just want to say this one last thing, Dr. Lee, and then I'm gonna let y'all have it. I want to say thank y'all again for allowing me to speak. To be a part of what we're doing. You know, it's great to be a part of everything that we're doing. All the way around the board. Much love to each and every last one of y'all. And kids, stay humble to your parents. Stay humble to your loved ones. Learn the lessons. Live the experience. Be blessed. Revelation.
Thank you so much. Thank you very much. We appreciate you joining us, and we appreciate your comments. And we look forward to hearing from you again. As we're wrapping it up before they shut us down, Dr. Moncrief.
Yes, thank you. Again, another excellent night. Some thoughts, some personal experiences that I have had. We're focusing on the youth. That we know are troubled, but for example, we're talking about the youth in Wayne County that Dr. Longs is seeing, and I know Dr. Longs has an office in Oakland County. But the background from a lot of the children from the city of Detroit is different than the background of the children, for example, the city of Southfield, which is in Oakland County. And the black kids are in trouble, you know, out in Oakland County also. And they tend to, at least the ones that come from Southfield, they come from two family homes, both parents working. Parents are educated. Nine times out of ten, they're not putting their kids out on the street to do things and commit crimes. And yet we see our children here in Oakland County still ending up in the judicial system. And I'll give an example. I'm bringing my groceries in one day, and a young man, could have been about 15 or 16, and he had a friend. He runs up and puts a gun in my face in Oakland County, okay? And I'm scared because he has a gun in my face, and I realize his hand is trembling more than I'm feeling afraid. And I had to tell him, please don't shoot me by accident. That's how scared he was and nervous he was. Mm. Okay? Mm. So we have these things, you know, going on, not just with our black youth who we can easily identify in our major metropolitan area like Detroit, but we have these same problems going on out in the suburbs with our black youth. We have to develop a program that will address all of that. And Dr. Lee, I would love, you know, I love hearing from our youth. We learn from our youth. But the parents of these kids out here in Oakland County who are committing these crimes, they are silent because they're embarrassed that their kids are doing this. I had a parent not tell us that his son was incarcerated in Florida, okay, because he was embarrassed. And because of that, his son didn't get any support other than his family traveling down there, and his son ended up being incarcerated for 10 years, okay? So I would love to hear from these parents of some of these kids who are being incarcerated, you know, their experience, you know, because all parents aren't bad, and the kids still go to jail. So those are my thoughts, and maybe a resource. Dr. Long mentioned Jalen Rose Academy. Mm-hmm. Maybe a resource list or something that we can get together and share with our youth and audience.
That's a great idea. And thank you so much. We appreciate you each and every week to acknowledge our co-host, Dr. James Cannon. And the floor is yours, sir. Thank you. Dr. Cannon?
Listen,
James Cannon.
No, this is Dr. Lee. Dr. Lee and to the team, this is such a valuable conversation when we turn towards our young people, male and female. My heart goes out to young people. Nick Cannon is my son. I have 5 other sons. And the things that I've tried to steer my sons around, I recognize now we have to help steer young men all around the country in the right direction. There's something now called trap music or drill music. And with this drill music, ladies and gentlemen, is worse than gangster music. They want to outlaw it in New York and Chicago, and it's kind of taking over hip-hop because these young people, not only do they want to stick a gun in your face and pull you out the bed and shoot you in the head, they want to be able to make a video about it and upload it to the internet, because the more views they get, then the record industry comes in and gives them millions of dollars because they got views about making videos and uploading it. And the police is perplexed because they trying to catch them. And so it is documented that it's real occurrences that's taking place, and it's our young people that's doing it. One of the solutions, if they're getting the messages through the music, y'all, we got to pay attention to the music. And we've got to stand against some of this music and get our young people to be able to understand the difference between good music and garbage music. And when we get them working with us, we get some of these pastors to open up some of these churches, to turn them in some of these rooms into studios, so we can supervise and work along with our young people in producing good music. If the music will sell all over the world and our young people love it, but there's some garbage music and they're sending messages about kill, steal, and destroy in the music that our babies are listening to, and we letting them listen to it. So tonight, ladies and gentlemen, this is an incredible conversation. I think if we pay attention to what our kids are listening to, and if it's garbage music, we need to be able to stand up to it and point it out to them and show them good music. Tell them, listen to some good music that we have for a week, and we'll listen to their garbage music, and then let's have a conversation. Dr. Lee, I appreciate you so very much, and we've got to do this, and we've got to take a listen at that drill music happening all across the nation, and it's our young people leading it, but it's these record companies that's paying them big money to come back into the community and flash, you know. So I appreciate y'all tonight, ladies and gentlemen. My heart goes. I come with some solutions. Let's get these churches to open up and turn some of these rooms into some studios so we can watch what our kids are producing. I appreciate you tonight. It's been an outstanding show.
Thank you, and I certainly appreciate you. And we will talk about these, making some steps towards getting studios into some churches. We'll see. You know, we'll talk about that. I appreciate your this solution. I haven't heard about the drill music, so this is new to me. Thank you so very much, Dr. Cannon. Dr. Long, for your final thoughts, and then Trace will take us off. Dr. Long.
My final comments were earlier again, where I wanted to give an apology to our young people for our lack of protecting them from all the horrors, as well as the false narratives about us within the country. And the conclusion was that to reverse all of this, you know, it's all of our responsibility, but I think we as elders, older, need to as Dr. Times says, get out of the way and let them lead because they can. And I remember once the goal was to employ them to save the black family, and they already know that. But some of them, what Dr. Cannon was saying, they may not, they know what needs to be done, but they don't want to necessarily hear it from us. So with that being said, there is hope. And good night to everybody. Again, look forward to next week.
Thank you. Trace. And we're off the air.
Oh, yeah. I just want to thank everybody for investing the time, energy, effort, and the mindset of elevating our people. I just want to give thanks to sum everything up. This was a success. It was very informative. There was a lot of new information. Make sure you stay tuned in. Every Wednesday at 9 p.m. God bless you guys. Thank you.
And thank you again. We appreciate you. We love you. This is Dr. Mary Lee. Until next week, stay safe.
Peace to the ancestors. Yes. Peace to Dr. Cornell West. Yes. Peace to the movement. Came from the bottom, ever since they got us, we've been going through these problems. 400 years behind and it's no promise that we gon' never actually be equal, to be honest. It's messed up how they put us in chains, kidnapped our language and changed our names. But when we speak Ebonics, then they call it a shame. They leave us with a couple options, rob or slain. Now we locked up a game, how much can our skin take? We went from slaves to inmates, carrying the weight of the 50 states. Working your forms, black nannies carrying white babies in their arms. Black men sacrifice their lives in your war. But you'll never show appreciation here at home. You treat us so damn wrong. You act like you hate my race. The police, they just beat us in the streets like an 808 base. America, when will you defend my case? It never will, cause your freedom is fake. I'm only living here cause I'm willing to get paid enough to round up all my family and shake.
Get up, get up, get
yeah.
Get up, get up, get up, get up, get up.
They done tore down all the PJs in my barrio. Gang units for worst case scenario. Might work, still a couple of quirks. Can't call it pancakes cause you're poor some syrup. It's a whole lot bigger than a pretty new house, especially when the road is still running about. P. Diddy running marathons, raising dough. That's going to the school where the tax money go. Homeland security, now there's a phenomenon. Pacifying folks by hanging Saddam. Troops still riding, still obliging. Still no Bin Laden. Tuned in waiting for the president's announcements. No 40 acres, take these 40 ounces. We ain't gonna get on the levees. Revolution televised early.
America,
is you ready?
Why you wanna treat me so cold? America, I done gave you all that I own. America, took me from my mama so young. America, locked me up and gave me your name.
Steady being forced to climb instead of have your back, have you beat and lost your mind. Especially when you done been down for so much time. Getting up don't even really ever cross your mind. You got porn shop, gun shop, liquor store sign. SWAT team, crack fiend, unemployed line. Stay late, dollar short, trying to buy time. What we do to survive is defined as a life of crime. You can't ball, then you forced to grind. If you fall, then you cross the line. And I've been putting in work from 9 to 5 and 5 to 9. Since phone calls cost the dime. What it made me is one of the relevant, highly intelligent brothers not only dealing with the same drug selling. If I'm a hustler, then what's more American? We all founded on the same thug heritage.
America, why you